We're joined by a great friend of the show. He is the director of the McGillicuddy Humanities Center at the University of Maine, a professor there, the author of the book 6 Minutes in Berlin, and his work is seen, well, in some of the best of the legitimate publications around the country. Michael Sokolow joining us. Michael, good afternoon.
Hi, Rich.
Excited to talk about the Olympics with you, and mostly because I didn't know they were here until you told me the other day.
Right, Rich, you're like a lot of Americans who are checking out of this year's event.
Yeah, I've been checking out of them for a while, but this one is interesting the more you dig into it. And I want to go back to something you said in a piece you wrote last fall, that the Olympics are a great venue for propagandists. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, for dictatorships or totalitarian regimes, the IOC, which is very corrupt, is easy to pay off, and then you can do these incredibly dazzling stagings that make your country, you know, look good to, especially to other dictatorships. I mean, people forget, right now, Putin is in Beijing, and he's taking part in tomorrow's opening ceremony.
I hope he has his shirt on for that.
Well, I don't, you know, this whole Ukraine thing is just going to be put on pause for 2 weeks, you know, because President Xi of China has asked him to you know, not do anything to ruin the big show.
Well, and the first question I would ask in regard to how we'll see all this is it a bit of an unholy alliance with the major television network that's covering this event, because they don't want to anger their hosts, I assume?
Well, it's a fascinating question. First of all, the number of NBC employees who are actually in Beijing is much lower than expected. They're going to be doing a lot of the broadcast out of Stamford, Connecticut, where they have an NBC headquarters. And so that, for starters, that's one way NBC's getting around it. But another way they're getting around it, which is fascinating to me, and you might see this in your Twitter feed or on TV, is, have you noticed it's always called the Winter Games now? All of their ads are for the Winter Games. They're never called they're not even called the Olympics. They're not called the Beijing Olympics or the China Olympics, or it's totally branded this time as the Winter Games, which is fascinating to me.
Well, I saw an interesting tweet that you had giving support to some journalists, Jake Tapper being one, who are reporting on what's going on in the midst of these Olympics. And you've said in the past that for sports journalism, this is a potential Red Smith moment. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, an interesting thing about that is Red Smith, who was very apolitical, people forget, because he was one of the first sports journalists to win a Pulitzer Prize, and he's beloved and famous in sports history, was that he was against politics coming into sport. Like, he actually was against Muhammad Ali not registering for the draft and all that. But in 1980 or 79, or no, actually it was early 1980, he wrote a column and he said, look, we really shouldn't go to Moscow. They just invaded Afghanistan, and it will help the reputation of the Soviet Union. And when Red Smith said it, it made a huge difference in public opinion and even the Carter administration, and we ended up not going to Moscow. What's interesting is this time, there aren't a lot of journalists standing up and saying what he said. The only one, I think the only really big one, was Sally Jenkins in the Washington Post, flat out said we should not be at the Beijing Games. But I haven't seen it anywhere else.
We're also seeing reports already of China making efforts to control what's said, at least internally, about their Olympics.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, they're also controlling the foreign press. I mean, you've heard about the China bubble. They're using COVID. It's very fascinating. They're using COVID as a really great way to operate a censorship regime without having to say they're doing that. You know, they're maintaining such an incredible bubble around the events and venues. It's really wild.
So between the COVID issues and the fact that this is an oppressive regime, is it a good idea for other countries to be participating in these Olympics?
You know, I would have supported the boycott movement, frankly. But, you know, every country has to make up its mind, for starters. But really, the villain here isn't the athletes should be competing. There's no question. There should be world championships and everything like that. The real villain is the IOC. Mm. The IOC made a huge mistake, and they didn't backtrack on it. They haven't done anything about it. And it's really, the IOC is sort of the sickening player here.
Do you think that this diplomatic boycott will have any impact?
You know, I'm fascinated to see that, and it'll be interesting tomorrow night when Putin is at the opening ceremonies and how that works, because China's foreign minister actually released a press release. He spoke to Secretary of State Blinken last week, and he released a press release saying that China vigorously, you know, contends that America must stop interfering with the Olympics. And what's hilarious about that is we're not participating. We're not sending anybody. We're not, you know, nobody from our government is going to be there. There's no official representation. And the idea that we were interfering with the Olympics was that, you know, our press is talking about things China doesn't want us to talk about, and that nobody showing up is considered interference. It's all very strange.
We're talking with Michael Sokolow here on Downtown. Now, in the past, countries have used the Olympics as a way to build facilities, as a way to bring in money. What is China's goal? Is it largely public relations?
Yes. It's public relations both internally and externally. Right now, if you look at the borders of China, they had a clash with India less than a year ago. They repressed Hong Kong. They're having arguments with Australia in the South China Sea, arguments with Japan. They internationally need, and Taiwan. We heard about the jets going over Taiwan and stuff. They really, really, really need an international brand reset. And this is what their goal is to create a new kind of image or brand for China. I don't think it's going to work in the United States. But I think it has a very strong possibility of working elsewhere in the world, especially Africa. China has gone to great lengths to raise its brand in Africa.
Now, we know traditionally coverage of the Olympics focuses on the personal lives of those athletes, but it's also a travelogue as well, and we learn about the country and the places. Are we likely to see less of that sort of thing?
Oh, absolutely. An interesting question is, we in America are used to the way NBC produces, but I worked at the Atlanta, Barcelona, and Sydney Olympics for something called the Host Broadcast Organizations, which is the IOC's official broadcasting arm. And there's a feed that the rest of the world gets that's produced by the host. And NBC very often takes some of those pictures, and you can't tell on your TV here in America. You can't tell what's NBC and what's the Host Broadcast Organization because they have the free rights to it. But there will be tons of pictures that you will see, that you will wonder how they appeared on the thing, and they appeared because they're outside the bubble and they are given to NBC by China. I do not think traditionally NBC has not labeled the stuff it picks up that way, but I think we will see a lot of landscape shots, a lot of very dramatic kind of shots, because that's just really part of the Olympics.
Do the Olympic Games, Michael, mean the same thing for athletes that they have traditionally?
You know, I think they do. I think the fact that they're every 4 years is what makes them so special. And we at the University of Maine, we have 7 athletes there in Beijing. And it's really, you know, it's a lifetime goal. Once, you know, these people, and I talk about this a little bit in my book, they compete. Your window of competing, I heard what you said about, you know, the football players moving between teams. Your window of competition as a world-class athlete is so short that it's like the apex of their lives. And so I do think no matter where they occur, for the athlete, they are the greatest moment in their lives.
So for the Olympic movement, what would be the best case scenario for these games?
The best case scenario would be, and this is going to happen, they're going to get, you will read in your newspaper that nobody's watching the Olympics on TV because the audience is only 10 million people. Yet that will still make them one of the most watched TV shows of 2022. And so the Olympic movement doesn't have to worry about that. The viewership will be there worldwide, and that's fine, even if the ratings are down in America. But, they have to rethink the entire way the bidding process works and the countries work. It's just so, first of all, nobody bid on 2024, 2028. They just handed it to Los Angeles and Paris. And I don't know if you saw, they just handed 2032 to Brisbane, Australia. Mm. There was no competition, no bids, no anything. And this is okay in Paris, Australia, and Los Angeles, I think. But down the road, there could be some serious, serious problems with all of this stuff happening. So the answer is, I don't know. You know, I don't know how to fix the Olympics. They may be too broken to fix. Remember when Ted Turner had his Goodwill game?
Right.
In 1986. You know, maybe that's what it's going to take, a billionaire out there to say, look, let's junk the IOC and try something new.
What about the idea of permanent host sites?
Well, you know, Greece would be, the nation of Greece is such an economic basket case that to put the Olympics back in Greece every 4 years would just be amazing. But the problem with that is there isn't enough money to bribe the IOC officials. It wouldn't, frankly, the corruption, the options for corruption are too low on that. So, I mean, I think it's a great idea, though.
Speaking of, because you know so much about journalism and the way these games will be covered, you talked about viewership, and I'm always interested in that because, like so much else, what those numbers mean are not the same as they've been traditionally because people now watch in so many different ways, and it may not really indicate at all a level of interest.
Exactly. I wrote a piece about it last year, the Tokyo Olympic Games. You know, if you believe what you read in the newspaper, the Tokyo Olympic Games were a terrible failure. Nobody was watching them. When, in fact, NBC made record profits. There was this thing called Peacock, you know, the subscription thing for the basketball. It was a huge hit, and it was one of the most, the Tokyo Olympic Games were one of the most watched broadcast or live streams in the year 2021 in the United States of America. People really wouldn't know that or think about it, but that's how things are changing. You know, it's so easy to get these Olympic broadcasts. You just turn it on your TV, it's there for free, or you get it on the stream and we're being flooded with it. But I think this Beijing one is an interesting one. There will be a huge audience. But right now, as we speak, Rich, the number one opinion article in the Washington Post is titled "I'll Skip the Olympics and You Should Too" by Jennifer Rubin.
Wow!
And it's actually number one. It was published 5 hours ago, and it is this argument that, you know, we should intentionally not watch and participate in these particular games.
Well, the Olympics, too, in terms of broadcasters, have made legends out of folks. The great Jim McKay, certainly Bob Costas in his long run. Who do you think will be the broadcast stars of these games?
That's a good question. I'm not following that closely, but I will say this: that's interesting. Is that I'm going to be fascinated by the games that are called in Connecticut. And I know that COVID and Bob Lucy are excellent football broadcasters, college football broadcasters, and COVID has kept you guys doing the show in a different ways. And I listen pretty intensely, and you do it really, really well. But even you, Rich, every now and then have a little bit of slippage, and that's the kind of thing that fascinates me. I'm going to be watching. So I'm not sure if maybe the best will be the ones. And now you'll never invite me back on the show for saying that, right?
No, you're absolutely right.
It must be really, really difficult to do, right?
Well, you know, the past fall wasn't so bad, but in that shortened spring season, we had a couple games. One in particular when I have to guess it was probably a crew of college students running the cameras and or directing, and they would zoom in on the quarterback and you'd see him drop back and release the ball, and then the camera would stay on the quarterback. So we had no idea. I would have to wait for the quarterback's reaction. Well, he looks happy, so I think someone caught it.
And I actually remember those games, and you were very honest with your audience. You were much more honest than I think the NBC people are going to be. But that exact same type of thing is going to happen. So I'm actually more curious. It would be fascinating if somebody does it really, really well, because the implications of being able to call a game really, really well off of a screen for the future of sports broadcasting are huge.
Well, yes, and Bob and I said on more than one occasion, perhaps we don't want to be too good at this, because that could be a great little money-saving opportunity for the company. Why do we have to send them on the road if they sound the same when they're sitting in a studio? So here's what I'm going to go with, Michael. Anytime we made mistakes, that was intentional, so we can go back on the road this coming season.
Sounds good.
Well, we enjoy all of your work. If you're not following Michael on Twitter, you should do that as well. Some great thoughts on the Olympic Games, and look forward to seeing how it all plays out here over the next couple of weeks. Michael, as always, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rich.
Michael Sokola from the University of Maine. If you haven't read his wonderful book, 6 Minutes in Berlin, make sure you get that as well.